to Scary Basement. Me and my friend Roxy have been trapped inexplicably and supernaturally in this basement, wherein lurks every scary thing that has ever been, including a floating knife, a slender man who is panhandling, a ghostly deer, and a pile of Hellraiser puzzle boxes. And one of them can be solved, and the other ones are unsolvable, so you'll never know if you're working on an impossible one or if you're just dumb and bad at puzzles. My name is Mikey McCaller.
And I'm Roxy Polk, and I'm worried about the hard times that Slender Man has fallen on, because he's panhandling down here. You know he's desperate, because people down here don't have money. I don't know what he's expecting to get.
And if they do, everything down here is evil, so they don't give it away.
Yeah. Or it would be cursed, so he's going to be in an even worse situation than he was before.
The other thing about Slender Man that, like, makes me feel bad is that, like, it feels like he hasn't had, like, his big money maker yet. It feels like he's like the Indiegogo on that grind of horror movie monsters. You know what I mean? He's never had a movie that, like, did box office. He's never had a video game.
They all did so poorly.
Right.
All of the Slender Man movies, man. And then the crime about those girls basically tanked his entire reputation, which wasn't even his fault. They decided that on their own to do that.
You know what? I feel bad enough for Slender Man. I am going to give him as much cash as I have in my wallet.
That's really good of you, Mikey.
And what I have in my wallet is a coupon for buy one, get one chicken sandwiches at Wendy's.
You know, if he ever makes it out of here, he'll be rolling in chicken sandwiches. So, you know, better than nothing. Slender Man's got to eat,
yeah.
Probably, maybe.
I should start panhandling.
What's your Roxy? It's me, the big boss. Now you're going to die. Now you're going to get died by my chainsaw. Unless you recap and review a horror movie.
I think we can do that. What do you think, Mikey?
He scared me. yeah, we can do that. We can do that. Roxy, I just saw this movie. I don't know if you've heard of it. The Borderlands. It's also called Final Prayer sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Have you seen it?
I was just going to say, have you seen The Final Prayer? Because I saw that. But then, yes,
okay.
It's also sometimes called The Borderlands. So, okay, good.
Pigbot, is that would that work for you? Will that stave off your chainsaw for another day?
Yeah, I haven't seen it, and I want to know what happens. I'm too scared to watch it myself. It's my big problem with horror movies. I want to know what happens, but I'm a scaredy cat.
Well, Pigbot, we can help you out. Roxy, are you ready to recap and review The Borderlands / Final Prayer?
Yeah, let's do it. Why don't we start by talking about who's in the movie? Sound good?
Perfect, perfect. The Borderlands / The Final Prayer. It's about a team of religious experts who have all come to a remote church to investigate what one priest says is a miracle. First, we have the surly deacon, who is a clergyman. Interestingly, he's a bit of a religious skeptic. Deacon travels around the world for the Vatican, investigating the veracity of these events that are supposedly miracles.
Then there's a quirky gray, a non-religious but spiritually interested fella who has technical expertise Deacon needs to conduct his most recent investigation into a quote-unquote miracle. Gray and Deacon's friendship is going to be the emotional anchor of this movie.
We also have Mark, who is Deacon's boss. He's a stick-to-the-facts kind of guy, very level-headed, get to the answer, move right along. He's deeply religious but doesn't talk about God as much as I'd want a religious guy to.
And then we have Father Krellick, the priest of a small congregation who observed and reported the miracle. Bloody nose and everything. He was there for it.
Later on, we're going to meet Father Calvino, who is an exorcist called on by the Vatican only in the most extreme and dangerous situations. Let's talk about the plot of this movie now that we know our linchpin characters. The movie, Final Prayer / The Borderlands. It has two titles. We should just get that out of the way. It's a nightmare for anybody searching for this movie. It sounds like everywhere else in the world, it was called The Borderlands. In America, it was called The Final Prayer. So that's
why the title
is what it is.
Legal problems, we assume. Maybe it's confusing for the Borderlands game. They're like, only we can own that word. So.
Yeah, imagine owning the word Borderlands. Like, all the lands are borders. The movie Final Prayer / The Borderlands opens with handheld camera footage of a man named Deacon at a church in the immediate aftermath of something going horribly wrong. Deacon's very upset. The police are there investigating. Deacon demands that the cameraman gets that bloody thing out of his face. We know we're set up for a found footage movie. We get a little bit of backstory on our main character, Deacon, and then we move away into another scene.
A few years later, we're in the British countryside, where we meet Gray, a lovable tech nerd who is in charge of setting up cameras and microphones to document a new investigation into a supposed miracle. He meets Deacon, who has been dispatched by the church to assist in that investigation, and while he is prickly, to be sure, Deacon shares a pint with Gray, and they stay up all night talking about God and solving a puzzle or something, I think. Real fun sleepover vibes.
Did you ever do that at sleepovers, Roxy? Just, like, stay up late and just be like, hey, Matt, do you believe in God? Did you do this?
Yeah, all the time. We watch, like, an anime VHS tape, and then we talk about God.
It does feel like what I was doing on a lot of sleepovers. Do you think Jesus would forgive me? Of course, the investigation is led by Father Mark, and he's late. Why would I say of course? We don't know Mark yet. Father Mark is late to run this investigation. So Deacon and Gray, who are by now our best friends, even though exact opposite personalities. Deacon's all surly. Gray's like, I love being friends. Deacon and Gray, best friends. They decide, to defy Mark's orders to wait for him, and they get cracking on investigating this miracle they're here to check out. They march up to the tiny, secluded church run by Father Krellick and ask him about this supposed miracle he observed.
Krellick shows Gray and Deacon footage of the miracle. It's your standard haunting. A few objects hover in the air, fall over, there's a baby crying. No big deal. You know, the priest does get a nosebleed out of nowhere. Not sure if that can be blamed on a poltergeist or a miracle.
Happens to me every autumn. It's not a sign of God.
Yeah, you sure there isn't a miracle happening every year in your house?
But when football season comes back, that is how I picture it.
Ooh.
This is a miracle unto me.
Deacon is sure it's fake, while Gray wonders if, hey, you know what? What if something is going on here? You never know.
Eventually, our stick-in-the-mud boss, Mark, arrives. He reprimands Deacon and Gray for starting without him. And then he finds a hidden space behind the altar with a staircase leading down into the darkness. But before Father Mark can check it out, a sudden ear bleed sends him home in agony. Ear bleed's a little more weird, less seasonal. Really is only supposed to happen if you're listening to music too loud, and only then after your mother has warned you multiple times to stop it.
That's what happens if you listen to music too loud. You'll lose all your hearing. While Mark takes a nap, Deacon and Gray continue poking around. They use an omnidirectional microphone to find hidden sounds, eventually hearing low growls and what can only be a baby's cries.
Then Gray and Deacon find the journals of the priest who ran the church before Krellick. And this fella, listen, he might have gotten mixed up with a little kind of evil pagan chicanery. Just a little dabbling in the devil.
Just a little.
It's scary.
You ever do that by accident, Mikey? Just fall into evil pagan chicanery when you live in a small town in the middle of nowhere in England?
You're Googling, like, the best journalism movies from the 90s, and then all of a sudden you're just, like, down a rabbit hole where you're learning about how to raise the dead and what you need to sacrifice to bring rotten beasts back. It happens.
The boys see Father Krellick outside, and a returning Mark follows him up to the roof of the church, where Krellick asks, if what he saw wasn't a miracle from God, then who was it from? After this, Krellick then leaps off the roof to his death.
It does feel like, I want to be clear, this miracle that he saw is just, like, a couple of things floating. He is not, like, it doesn't feel, like, it feels like they're very, like, horrified by this.
I remember thinking,
even if it's a spirit, it's not bad.
Was it like the ground rumbling, too, but they were, like, there wasn't an earthquake here, but everything was, like,
that's
shaking?
True. Yeah.
But still, I mean, if he thinks it's, so... I assumed he meant, like, does it mean it's from the devil and not God?
That's what I thought, too. But, like, yeah, it just doesn't feel, like, terrifying enough in a supernatural sense to justify a suicide. I don't know. I'm not here to question.
I mean, so the camera footage did cut out, like, after he gets the nosebleed, so maybe something happened afterwards that he didn't go into. I don't know.
He should have explained that.
Yeah.
And then I saw a clown. Clowns have been outlawed here since 1972. Deacon and Gray go out to the bar for another pint, and the whole town in this little Irish shanty, they're pissed off at these two because they believe they drove Father Krellick to commit suicide. a pissed-off Deacon, an ever-loyal Gray, decide to stick around in the town to solve the case, even if Mark has decided that it was all a hoax and it's time to pack things up. After Father Krellick is dead, Mark is like, well, he was the one who was poking and prodding us. Sounds like he was mentally unwell. Let's bounce on out of here.
They can't let it go.
Can't let it go.
This is where Deacon summons Father Calvino, the wily exorcist, who shows up to take a peek at the church. Calvino tells him that the church sits on a pagan sacrificial site. Churches used to build up on top of pagan sites, kind of a, I don't know, a flex move on top of them to just be like, fuck your pagan religion, it's Christianity now, bub. And they also do that to drive out the evil influences, I guess.
It's smart. Like, you notice that your enemy, like, it's like taking over your enemy's base, right? Not only do you cost your enemy a base, but now you are plus one base. It's smart military tactics. Father Calvino leads an exorcism with Gray, Deacon, and even Mark, who hasn't skipped town yet. They come and they sit down for this exorcism, right?
Mm-hmm.
During the ritual, the earth suddenly quakes and Calvino starts bleeding from his eyes. We've got a third orifice bleeding.
Not great. He's an old man. I don't know if he can take that.
I love that you're like worried about it. Like, he's too old for eye bleeding. Listen, if he was a young man and a track star, okay. His eyes could bleed all day. Listen, when I was in my peak physical health, my eyes would bleed all the time. And I can handle it.
You recover from it just fine. Just sleep it off, you know.
Take a nap. Get a new pillowcase since you bled all over yours. Father Calvino starts bleeding from his eyes. Mark disappears down the stairs in the secret panel he found behind the bookshelf early in the movie. You'll remember last time it caused his ears to bleed.
Just by looking at it. He didn't even go in there, right?
Now he's just like stumbling down. Yeah, he didn't even go in it.
Yeah.
He was scared. He was scared in his little boots.
And now they're just like, fuck it. we're going.
Marching in.
Gray and Deacon also follow Mark. They're not going to let him go by himself. And they find a stony basement labyrinth, a pagan altar, and the skeletons of all the babies that the previous priest sacrificed to whatever's down here. Could that have been how the baby screams and cries came from before? Maybe. Deacon and Gray press on, still trying to find Calvino and Mark.
The pair follow Mark into a tight, claustrophobic tunnel. Soon, Mark disappears. Gray and Deacon are trapped. They're like crawling on their stomach through this little rock cavern.
It's very scary, especially if you're claustrophobic, man, this scene.
Whatever, the forward progress is blocked, and then they find that behind them, they can't even back up to escape. Behind them is blocked. They're trapped in this tiny little corridor. And that's because once they look at the walls, they see that they are pulsing and fleshy. This tunnel they've found themselves in, Gray and Deacon discover, is in fact the digestive system of a massive creature. The massive beast's stomach acids begin to dissolve, Gray and Deacon. Gray screams, while Deacon, you know what he does, he finds his faith. He recites the Lord's Prayer, and that's the Borderlands / the final prayer. I couldn't remember what it was for a second.
Yeah. God, it's so haunting because, like, in that final scene, like, the whole time Deacon's just been saying, it's not a real miracle, it's not a real miracle. And Gray's, like, screaming, you said it wasn't real, you said it wasn't real.
Yeah.
As, like, the camera's glitching in and out and they're being dissolved and just screaming. My God.
Would you say this is the scariest moment from the movie? It's really upsetting.
Yeah, and I think because, like, there is a steady sort of unease and everything with the movie leading up to this point, but none of it is like shocking or off the wall like this. It all feels like it makes sense. Like, it doesn't feel like it came out of nowhere, but at the same time, it's like you never would have expected it to be like the hill is literally alive. The pagan site, they were worshiping a creature, or it's the land itself devouring them.
Yeah, it is a really interesting take on like a supernatural thing, right? This movie is very clearly like setting us up to believe that it is some kind of angel or demon doing this, which is like more of this ephemeral mythic kind of thing. And then you find out that it's just a monster. It's just a beast that lives. And it's like there, and it's got like this really, it almost feels like this really like grounded for all intents and purposes.
So I wrote down a quote that Gray says. He said, if I was going to pick a fight between something that's there and something that's not there, I'd pick what's there. So it's like the pagans were literally worshipping this thing that they found that is real. That, like, what else could you call it but a god? And it's like this Lovecraftian thing. Like, it's the land. It's alive. That's your god.
Yeah, it's a really cool idea that I was not necessarily expecting. It felt like we were already in the realm of the supernatural. And then this movie, at the end, it's like, surprise, you're in the cryptozoological.
Yeah, like, even the thing that woke up the monster in the first place was because that church had been kind of, like, not used for a long time. And it had been, it's a really small town that it's connected to. It had been so long since they had done a christening and there had been a baby in there. And so, like, the baby crying woke up the monster because it was conditioned to get sacrificed babies since time immemorial. So hearing a baby crying is literally what woke it up because it was like, oh, it's feeding time now.
Right. It's like when we smell spinach
Chipotle
dip.
Burrito.
Why did I think spinach dip? What a bad appetizer.
I know how much you love Chipotle, Mikey, so I would assume a Chipotle burrito activates your
Roxy,
food sensor.
Speaking of babies, what would you say is your favorite appetizer?
Speaking of babies, huh? My favorite appetizer, oh man. You know,
I might be a mozzarella sticks guy.
I can't believe I almost said that, Mikey. Because, like, whenever I see mozzarella sticks, I always want to eat them as the appetizer. But I'm like, I know how many calories there are. By the time I get my actual dinner, it's probably going to be less calories than whatever this was. Uh-huh. I can never say no to a mozzarella stick if it's in front of me. And every time I go to Arby's, I always have to get mozzarella sticks. They're so good.
What a great idea. They're like, we got all this cheese. Let's just fry it.
I love it. I think, like, any kind of fried thing, like fries too, like fries of any kind, nachos, or just like chips with dip is always good.
I think it might. I like that. I do like that sliced bread with spinach dip. That is a good.
I haven't had that before, but I'd eat that 110%. Give me some of that spinach dip bread. Sounds good.
One moment that we didn't bring up in this little plot recap we're doing here that I actually thought was maybe my scariest moment, and now that I'm realizing kind of doesn't fit with where the movie ends up going, there is this shot, because again, this is a found footage movie, which I think is always like a bizarre thing where, like, you are not, like, in any other movie, in Nightmare on Elm Street, they can do, like, a scene where friends are hanging out and then all of a sudden the wall turns into Freddy because you are subjectively showing the character's point of view as they fall asleep. With a found footage movie, you're theoretically just watching what a camera has recorded. So it's kind of, like, not susceptible to these, like, human, like, mistakes. You know what I mean? Like if you see a monster in a movie and then you, huh? And then you look over and it's just a tree. Like, you can do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In a found footage movie, we almost get a moment like that. I wonder if you noticed this also. There's a moment where Gray is looking at tombstones. And one of the tombstones says his name. It says Gray on it. And he, like, glances at it and then does, like, a, huh? And then goes back and it's got a different name on it. And it truly upset me. It made me feel like, oh, this guy's gonna die. Because it almost makes it feel like a noir where we know that the characters are already dead as the story is playing out. Like, that felt so ominous and so upsetting to me. I was just like, oh, fuck, this poor man. This poor man's already doomed by the supernatural. And then the fact that it becomes not the supernatural, almost like, well, wait, does this big lumbering creature have the power to change gravestones?
Yeah, I didn't even notice that at all. So it's very interesting that you bring that up. It makes me want to, like, go back and relook at that scene. And I wonder how many people did realize it, or how much of it is just, like, internally, maybe your brain saw it, but you didn't really process it. So you're like, you have this additional feeling of dread from it, maybe.
Yeah. And it's also weird because, like, I don't know. I think it's only because I was, like, taking notes on the movie that I knew what the characters' names were. So it's hard to connect that, like, it's not so much that you're reading your name. If I saw Michael McCullough on a grave in a movie, I'd be so scared I would never sleep again. But, like, seeing Gray, like, who is just a character I've kind of just met, and I haven't seen his face a ton because it's a found footage movie. Like, I hadn't really bonded with him yet. Like, it's just a bizarre thing, and it, like, an interesting detail that both freaked me out, and now as I'm talking about it, I kind of don't love, because it feels incongruous with this, the movie's ultimate big twist that it was just a beast. Although I guess if the beast is also doing, like, levitation, like, causing earthquakes makes total sense to me. And then, like, the sonically, and the ear bleeding.
I think it's, like, sonically the noises and stuff and just, like, its pressure or something of its existence is what caused the bleeding orifices. I think that was my guess anyway.
Even that, I can, yeah, that sounds right. I can buy that. It's just the levitation and the turning of the tombstone that I'm kind of like, whoa.
I don't know if it really even did so much levitation. It was just, like, moving objects, like a poltergeist, kind of. Was there a thing floating? Maybe I don't remember it as well.
Me too. Yeah, I'm struggling. I feel like something lifted up, but maybe it was just something moving.
Yeah,
because they were trying to find the strings.
Because yeah, like the reason why they have any amount of this like quote unquote miracle on videotape is because it was like a child's christening or baptism, one or the other. I don't know if they're the same thing, but there was like a family member filming it, so there was a reason for it to be filmed. And like with all of the camera setups here, each character has a camera on their head, and then we've got surveillance cameras. And the whole deal is that they want to be able to prove this thing is a miracle or not. So it gives, like, a natural reason for there to be cameras everywhere and for them to shift to have, like, certain specific shot choices. Like, you were talking about how, like, we actually do get some very specific, like, cuts and a way that they're able to kind of, like, pace things and frame things with a little more freedom than other found footage movies, because they can swap between each character's perspective, and then you have the observational cameras as well.
Yeah, though, I like those observational cameras a lot. That adds... It feels like almost too bad that Paranormal Activity has kind of captured the market on that, like, there is one camera watching the entire room. Because it did feel almost Paranormal Activity-ish to me.
Mm.
But it is a haunting camera setup, because we're seeing things that the character isn't. It's almost distancing us from the character, which is something I
making it feel
away
a little,
from in movies.
A little more real and observed, in a way.
Yeah. I think that's a cool idea. Yeah. I liked it.
There's this particular scene where these horrible fucking village children set a live sheep on fire in front of their place. So they're like asleep. They don't have cameras on them. So you see the security camera footage of them like running out and screaming and being really upset and trying to like douse this poor sheep who has been killed for the sake of these horrible hooligans to do what? Like, just to be assholes. It's very satisfying later when they walk up to these kids and Deacon literally punches one in the face when he's like trying to be a dick. He's like, yeah, whatever, bro. I set that sheep on fire. He's like, how dare you punch? I was like, yeah.
Not enough kids getting punched in the face.
Well, he was doing something truly horrible, like killing a poor animal, like as a prank to some strangers in your town for like no reason. I understand, like, maybe throwing paint or doing something else, but, like, you kill a poor defenseless animal for that, I want you to get punched and beaten up.
I think punching in the face is the best thing that any movie, just, like, in a vacuum, can do. I think it's always awesome.
It's like POV punching in a face, too, because it's Deacon's camera, him doing it.
I think about, like, Captain Marvel has this incredible scene where Captain Marvel just punches an old lady on the bus because she thinks she's a Skrull.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just saw one of my new favorite movies of all time, Bottoms.
Okay.
And it's about these young high school girls who start a fight club so they can get laid. And there's a lot of just, like, very funny, very vicious punching between all of these high school lesbians that fucking rules. Like, the best moments in movies are obviously, like, built up through context and characters that we grow to love or that we're invested in. But just, like, in a vacuum, the best individual scene in a movie is somebody funny getting punched in the face that you wouldn't expect to get punched in the face. Sorry, that's just my opinion.
And also, speaking of, like, animals, there's a thing, I actually noted this because it was 13 minutes into the movie, where there is, like, a dog killing and eating a rabbit, like, up on a hill. Like, it's not super close up, but they see it from a distance, and they're, like, freaked out. And Gray says, like, oh, big stuff eating little stuff, you know, that's nature or whatever. And then that's literally what happens to them at the end of it, big stuff eating little stuff. And I was like, man. That's an interesting foreshadow there. I like that.
That's a cool moment. Yeah, this movie feels like... I would almost like to watch it a second time just to see how, like... I love that feeling. Like, old film noirs are really, really good at this. How you, like, will open a lot of detective movies with, like... the character is... I'm thinking about, what movie is this? Is it The Maltese Falcon?
I haven't seen that one, sadly.
Double Indemnity? I think it might be Double Indemnity, where the main character opens the movie stumbling into his office. He's been shot in the stomach and bleeding out. And he like sets up his tape recorder and he's like, well, I'm probably going to die. Here's my story. And so then that gives you voiceover throughout the movie. But just the whole movie has this real sense of dread to it because we know this character isn't going to make it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most upsetting feelings in any movie where you always have this moment where pretty early in the movie, like in Double Indemnity, it happens where the woman the main character is like an insurance adjuster and he plans to murder a woman's husband along with her so they can collect the insurance money together.
And it
similarly happens in this movie where Mark is like, hey, we should probably leave. We should not do this investigation anymore. And you always can see the main character considering it, but because you know, and I think I knew in Final Prayer because I saw Gray's grave early on, and in Double Indemnity, you knew because you've seen the gut shot man talking to his tape recorder. You know they're not going to take this escape, but you want them to take it so bad. You're like, pull it, like, just leave. Just get out of Ireland. There's nothing good for you here. The devil wants you. Or you're going to get shot because, like, this is a bad idea to murder a man for insurance money. And I hate that feeling so much that whenever I, like, park my car on a street sweeping sign, and the next day I'm like, oh, I've got until noon to move it. It's only 8 a.m. I don't need to move it yet. I think about that moment in film noirs where I'm like, this is my chance. This is the woman saying, like, maybe we shouldn't murder my husband. This is Mark saying, maybe we should get out of Ireland. And I'm like, okay, I'm in control of my destiny right now. I'm going to go move my car right now. And I do, and I don't get tickets.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on something which is kind of like one of the main themes of the movie. Is like Deacon and his stubbornness gets everyone around him killed multiple times. Like he refuses to grow and just thinks he knows better, which like the opening scene in this movie is about his big failure that he lies to Gray about, where he was on this case investigating a miracle. And it turns out that it was like set up by this cartel to try and make it a miracle and make it like, I don't know, a very famous thing that they could make money off of, essentially. And he and the other priest there discovered it. And so instead of waiting for, like, the Vatican or the police force or any other backup, they just kind of, like, went in there to try and solve it and called them out. And it got literally everybody else there killed except for him.
Yeah.
He was the sole survivor. So it's one of the reasons why, like, he's been ostracized by the church and it's kind of like nobody likes him, and why Mark is very argumentative with him and doesn't like him when he shows up. Also, with him and Gray being buddies, Gray feels betrayed, and he's like, you didn't tell me about this. Like, you lied and said it was something else. So, like, it kind of creates a break in their friendship, too. And because Deacon cannot get over that, cannot get over himself, cannot imagine a world where, like, he's wrong, he gets Gray killed. And Mark and Father What's-His-Face, presumably, as well. And then himself.
Father Fonzarelli.
Okay, Fonzarelli.
It's not his name. It's something like that, though.
Calvino is his name.
Calvino.
Yeah,
what
so
if it was the Fonz, though? What if he was like, while his eyes were bleeding?
Mark would be that. Oh, no, Calvino would be that, yeah.
Something we haven't talked about a ton, but it was actually, I think, the best part of this movie is this friendship between Deacon and Gray. It's my favorite character dynamic between two characters of all time, where one's kind of surly and one's kind of silly, but somehow they're just like immediately bonded. They're best buddies no matter what. I love that dynamic. I think they're so much fun.
Yeah.
They love each other instantly, even though they're like, aw, you. And he's like, aw, me.
Yeah, like Gray is so friendly that he like kind of brings Deacon around. You get the impression that like Gray can be friends with anybody. And the person that he's stuck with is Deacon, this guy who doesn't want to be friends with anybody. And guess what? But he's going to be his friend, whether he likes him or not. So it's very cute. Just dudes being bros.
And then the other aspect that's very interesting to me about this movie is that, like, it's about faith.
Yeah.
It's about, like, is there a God? Is there a possibility for miracles? And I think what makes this movie interesting, and again, makes it feel so noirish, is that it's kind of bleak. It ultimately comes down on the side of, like, no, there's no such thing as miracles. There's tangible creatures, and sometimes you lose to them.
I think
you are just the smaller thing being eaten.
Yeah, they kind of are having this like holistic a lot more kind of like upfront discussion of faith and about how they each feel, especially because like Gray himself is not religious, but he's kind of agnostic. He's like, I want to believe something's out there, but nothing has convinced me so far. You know, a lot of it is just like old men writing books and saying they know better. So it's one of the reasons why he's like so intrigued by an actual tangible thing. And then Deacon, who has been like just so wound down or run down by investigating like for decades and decades and it seeing no tangible proof. He even recounts this story about how a mother abused her child to fake a stigmata thing. And then when the girl finally died from all of the abuse, she was like, oh, cool. Now they can make my girl a saint. Like, no remorse for this horrible thing she did. And so he's not only lost his faith in faith, but it feels like he's kind of lost his faith in humanity as a whole by the time he gets to that. So we've got, like, a very optimistic person who wants to believe in something and somebody else who is just like, everything I've seen tells me nothing is real. And then you got Mark who comes in who is like, we need to get out of, like, the Dark Ages and enter the 21st century. You know, we can't just keep saying these fake miracles are around. We need to, like, you know, be cool and hip and more technologically, like, I don't know, in line with what's happening in the modern age.
We should talk to the kids less about God and more about Danny Phantom.
Yeah, I don't know. He's kind of like talking about it in a capitalistic sense or something almost, like as if it's a business or something in a way. Yeah.
What if we had Jesus in Fortnite?
Yeah, basically. I wonder if he would. That's how we'll communicate to the kids, you know. And you know what? It'd probably work if they did it.
That would be cool.
But yeah, it is interesting to have this like larger question of faith and discussion of faith. And I think that, yeah, it's kind of saying that like maybe the real thing under the hill is your God. Maybe there is no other God. Where there isn't kind of like a lot of substantial things of them showing stuff to the contrary, but yeah, I guess it does kind of have that bleak sort of ending in that way. I mean, especially when our two buddies get killed. And again, like I said, it's because Deacon couldn't let go and because Gray wanted to believe his friend and that maybe something was out there. And like, we never know what happens to Mark or Calvino because they could have just been apparitions. They might not have even made it down there or something. Yeah. Or they got eaten before the other boys did.
Or they saw the monster and they were like, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I'm get the fuck out.
They did that Scooby-Doo thing where they're like, their legs go like...
They're running in place.
Pew! Yeah. Zip away. Roxy, do you have anything else to say about the Borderlands / Final Prayer?
I do not think there is, actually. It was a good movie, and there's a lot to talk about. Oh!
Then it's...
Yeah, they were doing, like, their boys' night when they first got to know each other. I wrote down, dudes doing a puzzle, getting high, and whatever. Dudes being bros, I guess.
Roxy,
Deacon is the first one to buy booze as well. He just straight up buys booze. That's cool. Their initial bonding moment. Gray's like, really? Okay, cool.
Roxy, have you ever done a puzzle with people before?
Like, with my parents when I was a kid, but I'm not, like, a big puzzle person, maybe just because I lack the space to have it, and I had a cat once, which meant I couldn't set anything out for long periods of time. What about you?
One time I've done a puzzle with other people, I was doing a Christmas haunt around an entire neighborhood.
Ooh.
So it was, like, a scavenger hunt kind of haunt.
That sounds fun.
And it was very fun. And very cool, but the very first thing they do is they have you meet all the teams meet in the same place, and then they give you a puzzle to put together, and then once you finish the puzzle, you can leave. Like, you get your first clue, and then you go out into the town and begin the scavenger hunt.
Okay.
Roxy, I am so bad at puzzles. My team, we just sat there, and we couldn't figure it out, and everybody was leaving, and we were just behind. We're like, are we gonna just do a puzzle all night that we're bad at? And eventually, the crew came up to us, and they're like, guys, you can just go if you want. Here's your clue.
Oh, man.
I hate doing puzzles with people. Therefore, I don't want it.
Okay, I'll remember to never do a puzzle with you, Mikey. I don't want you flashing back to
absolutely
this trauma.
Not. I will throw it in the fire. Roxy, do you have a question for me?
I sure do. So, in this movie, characters investigate a miracle. So I was wondering, Mikey, which fictional character would you pick to help you investigate a supposed miracle?
I want to talk about Turk from Scrubs. Did you watch Scrubs, Roxy?
Yeah, not as many as you did, but there was a time when it was on Netflix where I watched like a big chunk of them.
Turk from Scrubs is exactly religious enough that I would really vibe with him. I feel like they do a Christmas episode every season, and that's kind of the only time that Turk's faith gets brought up. But he's
really?
Yeah, I believe in God. Yeah, and he's just, like, chill about it. It's just, like, it's not a big
deal.
It's
not his whole identity, but it's just a part of him. Yeah.
Exactly. He's just religious enough that he would keep it fun. Turk feels like a fun guy in general. He's got interesting ideas. He's a surgeon, so if something happens to me, he could save me.
There you go.
With doctor training or with cutting me open and perhaps extracting a ghost with surgery. There's not a lot I wouldn't want to do with Turk from Scrubs, but especially investigating a miracle, that's tops.
Yeah, he seems like he's a fun hang no matter what you guys are doing. That's one of the few things I know about Scrubs. Turk is fun.
Turk is fun. Who would you solve a miracle with?
So I went a little bit more the analytical route, where I picked a famous fictional detective, Hercule Poirot, who is one of my favorite fictional detectives, specifically the one that is played by David Suchet. I love him, and he's an expert detective, pays attention to little details. He'd be able to figure out if it was a miracle or not pretty quick. I'd feel pretty confident having him do a lot of the heavy lifting for me there.
Just for my own reference, this is the detective that Kenneth Branagh is playing in, like, these Death on the Nile movies, right?
Yeah, I don't like Kenneth Branagh's interpretation of this character. It's a little strange and off-book for what the character is like. It feels like a different character, which is fine. I'm more thinking of, like, the actual character from the original Agatha Christie books, and then there was a BBC, like, very long-running series that I grew up watching as a kid. That had the actor David Suchet playing him, and he's very close to the actual portrayal in the books.
So he's logic-minded, he's getting to the bottom of it, he's not entertaining any of the faith-based stuff.
No, he probably wouldn't, actually, yeah. Yep, be a little more analytical. But if there's something that he couldn't explain, you know, I feel like he would be able to defer to that. So if, like, there was something he couldn't explain, then it's gotta be real, right?
The current Kenneth Branagh iteration of that character is about to do a haunting in Venice.
Yes. As much as I'm like, that's not Hercule Poirot, but it's still like a fun detective movie. So I'll still like want to watch it anyway. And then, this one is like a scary one, which I don't even know if this is based on one of the books. I don't know.
I just think that's interesting.
We got to watch
cool
it.
Idea.
We got to watch it. Tina Fey's in this also, which I was like, what is that Tina Fey?
What a great cast. God, I love it.
Guys, you're talking about other movies. Talk about the movie. Give it a rating on a scale from 1 to 5 thumbs. I got a big box of thumbs if you want to use one.
When did he pick that up?
Wait, listen,
we're supposed to have that.
Fair enough. He's got a new box of hands.
Oh my God.
That look as though they've been freshly chainsawed off other people.
That's what he was doing the whole time when we were talking about the movie, wasn't it?
Roxy, we can't argue with the pig bot. Let's give this movie a rating on a scale from 1 to 5 thumbs. What would you give this movie?
I actually gave it 4 thumbs because it manages to be like very engaging. Despite the fact that it's like a small budget and a found footage movie, I think they like used their premise to a very exacting degree to show what they wanted to show. And the revelation at the end, the first time I saw this movie, it took me by surprise in a way when I was like, holy shit, I can't believe they did that. And it, like, stuck with me. So I thought that was pretty fun. And, like, after we went through it, too, like, they seeded that very off-the-wall thing pretty exactly. And, like, they throw in some lore stuff that they don't really, like, hang around on and, like, waste a lot of your time on. So I think it's, like, says just as much as they need to, is just as vague as it needs to be. And, I enjoyed it a lot. What about you, Mikey? How many thumbs did you give it?
I gave it 4.5 thumbs up.
Oh, so, damn. Okay.
Pigbot, if you could cut this thumb in half. Maybe a little excessive.
Yeah. I mean, it's some precision work that I don't know if Chainsaw can really do it, but he tried.
Turn the other half of that thumb into just mush and really sever it the way I need it to be. I give it 4.5 thumbs just because I am so enamored with their friendship. I feel like this movie, it doesn't have a lot. It's like more interesting than it is emotional, but like the friendship got me the emotional part. And the ending is such a banger that I'm like, that's an extra thumb for the ending alone. Like, what a cool, interesting choice. What a scary idea. What an interesting twist on this kind of supernatural, like, is the devil interacting with our church? It's like, no, a being is. And yeah, I just really loved it.
Man, you're making me a good movie. Wish I had maybe given it an extra half of a thumb, but I don't think I want to ask Pigbot to do that again. So I think I'll keep it for it. But yeah, it's
not
great.
Worth it. It's honestly not worth it.
All right, bastards! I'm tired about talking about this movie. I get it. If it comes up at a party, I'll be able to talk about it. Next, I want you to talk about something completely different. Talk about something else. Different movie or TV show or video game.
Roxy, we need to give the Pigbot a palate cleanser recommendation. He is not stoked to be on this conversation topic for so long. Book or movie or TV show or amusement park or overall entertainment experience do you consider the opposite of the Borderlands / Final Prayer?
So this movie was all about someone who thought he knew better and got his crew killed two times and then himself. So I picked Kitchen Nightmares.
Oh!
It's a show about people who think they know better, even though they're tanking their life, their crew's lives, and their business. Mm-hmm. Yet by the end of an episode, most of them, not all of them, but most of them, learn their lesson. They're in the process of turning their life around, making better choices for themselves, their families, their business, their crew. All with the help of Gordon Ramsay, big personality, big star chef, who... As much as he yells at people, he is always just trying to get them to live their best lives. And of course, make money off of his TV show doing it. But, you know, he's always giving solid advice here. Like, how can you not listen to it?
Gordon Ramsay, rather, does feel a lot like the giant monster underneath the church.
Oh, okay. I like this interpretation.
If only because of how many people's eyes bleed when they interact with him. I will tell you, the palate cleanser recommendation I have, I think you've read these books. I think we've talked about them before. Have you read His Dark Materials, Roxy?
I haven't, but I remember we talked about them once because we couldn't remember the title of something else. But I don't actually know what they entail. What are they?
The His Dark Materials books fucking rule. They're Harry Pottery books that are kind of about, like, if instead of being wizards, they hated God. It's like this really fervently anti-religious book about, like, the villains of the series are the church, and
Holy
the
shit.
Main character is, like, trying to go kill try to kill God.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, it's like every JRPG, they kill God. So
yeah,
I'd be right at home if I played this.
But in the His Dark Materials book, there is a giant, enormous creature who is a polar bear who wears armor.
Oh.
His name is Eorik Bernsson, and he would never eat you alive.
Oh.
He would never eat anybody alive. He eats people when they're dead. And it's a sign of respect in his culture that he devours the dead bodies of fallen warriors. And I think that is how I want to go. I want to die in battle, and I want to be eaten by my friends.
Is that how the jars in Elden Ring work as well? Those guys do something similar.
I'm not familiar with their mythos. It could be.
Okay.
It could be.
I thought that you played Elden Ring.
You gotta read a lot of, like, the detailed explanations of how, like, your potions work in your inventory.
Oh, I thought, like, there's just a part where, like, the big jar guy who you're acquainted with, I can't remember his name, but you, like, hit him in the butt to get him out of somewhere where he's stuck, that guy. Like, he's on a battlefield, like, picking through dead bodies. And he's like, oh, this is most unsightly. Sorry, but I just have to do this so I can be stronger or something.
Oh.
So does the polar bears in this movie get stronger when they eat fallen warriors, or?
No, it's just like them eating big hunks of meat. But they only do it to the warriors that they truly respect. It's like a sign that, like, I am so endeared to you that I will use your body to power my body. And I love that. I would love to be consumed.
I mean, it's
by you, Roxy.
By me. Okay, yep. So you're asking me to become a cannibal in your will. Are you adding this to your will?
Yes. Yep. I will put that in my will. I need you. You specifically. You can cook it if you want. That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, that makes it better. For those of you who don't know, Mikey has a very specific will set up where I'm going to make a Resident Evil style puzzle with his tombstone.
Yeah.
But I think there was also some sky burial possibly involved, and now there's also cannibalism, so the list is getting quite long.
You can, okay, yeah, because I also want to get sky burialed. You can hack off one limb and just eat that.
You know what, Mikey? How about the rest of it? With all of the thumbs up ratings we do, how about I take one of your hands and have it embalmed in a permanent thumbs up thing? And
I would
to
love
eat
that.
Later, quote unquote, later.
That's no, you fine, have to right? eat the arm, but you can save the hand.
Okay.
That's what I want to happen at the end of my life. But at the end of the podcast, what we do are haunted plugs.
Hell yeah.
Roxy, you can find Scary Basement on Twitter at @scary_basement. You can find us on Instagram at @scarybasementpod. And you can find us on YouTube, youtube.com/@scarybasementpodcast. Go watch some videos. Go see some sketches. Go subscribe, like, hit that bell. You know we love you. That's good. Roxy, where can people find you on the internet?
That's great, Mikey. People can find me on Twitter, Twitch, and now Blue Sky as Red Mage Roxy. And on Twitch, I stream 3 days a week, which is Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday. Come check me out.
You can find me, Mike McCaller, on Twitter at Secret Blimp, on Blue Sky at Secret Blimp, and on Twitch at twitch.tv/secretblimp. I stream Tuesday and Thursday mornings, 10 a.m. PST. What a great time it is.
Yeah, you guys, come join us on Twitch on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You get a double dose. Mikey in the morning and Roxy in the evening. Hell yeah.
Mikey in the morning, Roxy in the evening, pizza at supper time.
Hell yeah. And after you do all that, you can also leave us a 5-star review. That really helps us out. Whatever your listening apparatus of choice, please give us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate it.
And if you're a horror movie person and you know more horror movie fans in your life, tell them about this podcast, send them a link, ask them what their favorite horror movie is. We've probably talked about it. Send it on over to them. Spread the word.
And you can also check out our Patreon. We are part of the Super NPC Podcast Network. You can find it at patreon.com/supernpcradio. Me and Mikey do a monthly horror game podcast over there, talking about scary games called Press X to Scream. And all the other folks over there are doing tons of awesome podcasts as well. We're doing the Games Club currently, as of recording. We're doing the Sonic Games Club. And we got all kinds of other cool video game podcasts over there.
Check it out. And now we're going to do our best to slink away before the pig bot notices. See you next week.
Let you go!